This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel, in for Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, Learning in the Line of Fire. Afghan villagers protect their school after an attack by the Taliban.
The people of Goldara volunteered their time. We knew the police couldn't do the job on their own. The opposition forces don't want our children to be educated. They want to keep our people in darkness.
And it's cats against cattle in Kenya. Lions and leopards are killing the livestock of Maasai herders. Plus, bloggers in China shake things up in the wake of the earthquake.
Through all these blogs, there's so many more bold questions being raised that were once unthinkable.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. In Afghanistan, there's been a sharp increase in violence over the last few months. The Taliban have staged something of a comeback there, and many civilians are nervous. People in the village of Goldara are particularly concerned about the village school. The Taliban attacked the school in 2006, but the villagers have rebuilt it, and now they're putting their lives on the line to keep the school open. Will Everett brings us this report.
About 20 high school boys sit two to a desk as they repeat after their English teacher, "I do my homework." The open windows let in a dry breeze from the parched hills in the distance. A year and a half ago, no one was doing any homework in this school, about an hour's drive north of Kabul. 16-year-old Razmin, a 10th grader here, recalls the night when Taliban insurgents broke into the school.
It happened around midnight. It was dark, so no one could see who did it. There were several guys. They broke out windows and poured gasoline everywhere and started a fire.
The arsonists were members of a Taliban group that had made public threats against the school when girls began attending it, although in segregated classrooms.
All the textbooks, chairs, and desks were destroyed in the fire. We thought the government would help us, but they didn't respond.
Today, the school is protected by a mud brick wall with a steel gate. Looking at the clean, newly painted buildings, it's hard to believe that this was the scene of Taliban violence. Azhar is one of the volunteer watchmen who'll take his turn tonight guarding the school.
After the attack, the villagers got together and said, "No more." We rebuilt the school and organized round-the-clock guards to protect it. We persuaded the district police to make regular patrols.
According to the Afghan Ministry of Education, insurgents burned down 187 schools in 2006. Another 350 closed down because of security threats. Azhar knows there isn't much he can do against an armed Taliban attack. He carries an old rifle that shoots buckshot and a cell phone so that he can report any incidents to the district police station. He doesn't have any children in this school, but he's proud to help protect it.
The people of Goldara volunteered their time. We wanted to protect the school. We knew the police couldn't do the job on their own. The opposition forces don't want our children to be educated. They want to keep our people in darkness.
Saeed Zechariah has been a teacher here for 5 years. He recalls that during Taliban rule, girls were not allowed to go to school and boys were taught only religious subjects. Today, nearly a third of the students in his school are girls. But for conditions in Afghanistan to continue to improve, he says, education must be a high priority.
I'm an educated person, and I want to help educate the next generation of Afghanistan. Only with education can Afghans learn to solve their own problems.
A teacher rings a bell in the schoolyard, signaling the end of the school day. As the students all head for home, Azhar, the watchman, stays behind. He'll soon be joined by another volunteer, and they'll spend the night staring into the darkness of the outlying hills where the Taliban are camped.
We don't know if this will happen again in the future. We hope it won't happen again, but it's our job to protect the future of our kids.
For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Goldara, Afghanistan.
Yalandap kanan özüt gün
June is the perfect time of year for a safari, and usually tourists from around the world would be heading to Kenya's Masai Mara. That's a game reserve famous for its natural beauty and an abundance of game. But the violence that followed Kenya's contested election late last year has meant a dramatic drop in the number of people visiting the region, and that has had some unintended consequences. Richard Locke reports.
High on a windswept escarpment, a 12-year-old boy ushers his herd of goats towards home. Below him, for as far as the eyes can see, sweep the golden savanna plains of the Masai Mara. When he reaches his village of Enkereri, his uncle, Mani Kipas, the village chief, welcomes him home. In the swirling wind, Chief Kipas stands outside his homestead, wrapped in a traditional checked purple blanket. The homestead is known as a boma, and it's surrounded by a 9-feet-high circular ring of tree branches and thorn thickets. Behind, there's a similar interior fence, which serves as a pen for the village's cows, goats and sheep.
So this is our door, you see, to close in the night. So the night coming, we pull the middle of the entrance and we pull some branches of tree. So that when the cow, sheep, goats and people come in, we just put all this on top of the door. We close and nobody can pass here.
But the two lines of defense aren't enough to hold back the lions and leopards that roam the neighboring national park. For generations, the Maasai have lived in conflict with wild predators. Already this year, the big cats have made more than a dozen raids on Chief Kipas's boma.
Since January, about many of them, about 5 cows, 10 sheep and goats, yeah, and 1 donkey, and there many dogs.
Cows are a Maasai's life. A family's wealth is measured not in money, but in cattle. So the temptation to spear the lions and leopards is great.
Our cow is our bank. Yeah, very important. Our cow is very important because when you have problem, you sell the cow. So that's my money. So it is stolen my money. So what you do with theft? You just kill him.
The only thing that's been stopping the Maasai from killing the predators is a compensation program set up by the Mara Conservancy. The Conservancy manages the southern half of the game park. It uses park entrance fees to fund projects like the cattle compensation program. Under the program, the Maasai receive the market rate for each animal lost to a lion or leopard. In return, they promise not to kill the predators. Since the program started 7 years ago, the surrounding lion population has doubled from 40 to 80. In that time, the Maasai here have not speared a single lion. For the Mara Conservancy, the program is well worth it. 300,000 visitors come here on safari in the hope of seeing Africa's Big Five, including those predators that have a taste for Maasai cows. That is until last year, when the results of the contested presidential election led to an explosion of ethnic violence. The images of machete-wielding mobs rampaging across Kenya prompted many Western safari-goers to cancel their holidays. Visitor numbers are down a staggering 80%, and the tourist dollars that used to keep the compensation program running have dried up. For his 5 cows, 10 sheep and goats, and a donkey, Chief Kipas should have received over $1,500. Instead, he's received nothing. 27-year-old Masek Kipiko says the elders are losing their patience.
In reality, they don't understand why we don't kill them. They have to say, look here, all the time the goats are being killed, we're losing cows, and nobody's coming in to say we're going to do something.
Kipiko's picked up his American accent working at a nearby luxury lodge, popular with Americans. He says the younger Maasai have a different understanding of the value of wildlife, and have been working with park rangers to dissuade the elders from tracking the predators and killing them.
Some of us are working in the lodges. It means that the animals, the land, and the tourists are keeping the wheel rotate. We tell them, look here, we get the tourists coming here. If we try to kill all these animals, we end up knowing the other source for the tourists to come in.
The villagers at Enkereri don't just benefit from tourist dollars through the compensation program. In a normal year, thousands of safari enthusiasts pay to visit this village and buy traditional Maasai jewelry from the women here. Kalito Kanaya sits on the ground as she makes a necklace out of brightly colored beads. Only a handful of tourists, she says, have passed through in recent days.
We're making necklaces while we wait for the tourists to return. When they come, we sell our jewelry. That means we can afford school uniforms and shoes for the children.
In fact, last year, the villagers were able to build a nursery school with the money they earned from foreign tourists. For generations, Maasai children have traditionally herded animals instead of going to school. But Kipas says that's now changing.
We use that money, instead to buy a cow, we build a school. We need education. We need education.
So, for the villagers of Enkereri, to talk of killing predators is a sign of how desperate they are to save their livestock. Some Maasai have already resorted to drastic measures, selling some of their cows, the Maasai equivalent of emptying a bank account. Park officials hope the world-famous wildebeest migration will finally draw tens of thousands of tourists back to the Maasai Mara. But that's not for another 3 months, and even then, officials can't be sure whether foreigners will consider Kenya safe enough to visit. If they do, and the tourist dollars start flowing once again, then the Mara Conservancy says it will pay all the compensation money it owes the Maasai. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke, in the Maasai Mara, Kenya.
Later in the show, we'll hear from Richard again. In a reporter's notebook, he'll tell us about one Maasai Mara ranger who's found an unusual way to raise money for his game reserve. Stay with us for that. In southeast Turkey, there's a centuries-old tradition in which members of ruling families own huge areas of land in this very rural part of the world. But they don't just own the land, they also own the villages on that land. That means that what happens in a village is decided by the ruling families, with very little input from anyone else. But as Dorian Jones reports, some villages would like a more democratic approach, and they're starting to challenge the ancient system.
In the village of Sinan, a man sings a traditional song about the hard life of villagers. The song blames the all-powerful rule of the Aa. While the song is more than a century old, little seems to have changed. Under the village's solitary tree, men sit on low stools and chat over tea about their struggle with their Aa. Among them is farmer Mehmet Kaya.
How can it be that one man can own thousands of square miles and the thousands of people who live there? Like our fathers and their fathers, we live under the Aa. He tells us whether we can build a new house or not, where we can grow our crops and let our animals feed.
Like the rest of the villagers, Kaya usually gives a percentage of his crops to the Aa as payment for the use of the land and his home. Villagers are also expected to help the Aa work his own farm. Another farmer, Osman Tash, took me on a tour.
We're coming to the school, which was another point of confrontation between the village and the Aa. This would have been a very important institution for the village, but the roof is completely destroyed. So why is the school in such a bad way?
Of course, it's because the Aa does not want our eyes to be opened by education. So he wants to stop our children learning. He does everything to prevent the repair of the school and also the building of a new one. The Aa sends his children to England to school, but our children don't even have a school to go to.
Here's another testament to the destruction of this ongoing conflict. This was once home to three families, a two-bedroom village house, but now it's just a pile of rubble. What happened to this building?
The family here was in a land dispute with the Aa. He came with a gang of men with machine guns and said, "This is my land, my house, my village." and if you don't leave, this house will be your grave. The next day, he destroyed it.
How do you feel when you see this building?
I am filled with hatred. I wished our fathers had fought against this, but they didn't. They felt powerless.
That anger has inspired Tash to take the lead in a daring step. The villagers are challenging their Aar's power. In front of the parliament building in Ankara, about 100 villagers chant, "We want freedom and an end to the rule of the Aar's." While they received a polite reception from politicians, there's little government appetite to challenge the formidable political and financial power of the Aar's. I met with the local Aar, Omer Çetin. The protest against him is a talk of the region, but he has little sympathy for the villagers' position.
The Aar has the right to expel villagers from their homes. It's like a factory owner faced with hundreds of workers who say they want more rights and want to own the factory. He would sack them. But Aars play an important role for the state and the region. It's easier for them to work with an Aar than trying to deal with hundreds of thousands of illiterate people. For centuries, the state here has been very weak. There was little law and order. It's now the Aar who have power. They've helped to run the region.
But Çetin acknowledges that the status quo is under threat.
Things are changing. Through education and TV, villagers are becoming more aware of their rights. You now have to pay your villagers for work they do, and you must be more aware of their needs.
The noon call to prayer summons mourners from the village of Çınar, only a few miles down the road from Sinan. Two children are being buried. They were killed in crossfire after a land dispute between an Aar and his villagers ended in shooting. Abedin Attan is a local journalist. He says while many villagers still welcome the stability and order the Aar system brings, such conflicts are becoming more common.
In my village, the Aar family has guns, and the villagers have guns. This whole region is now awash with guns. Before, it was totally different. The villagers were so oppressed, they would not even say a word against the Aar. Aars would swear at them, beat them, kick them. Now the villages are becoming more empowered.
Back in Sinan, villagers say they will never give in to their Aar's rule again, whatever the cost. They hope that victory will come without violence, through success in the courts. With millions of other villagers in the region sharing similar grievances, the outcome of this struggle could have far-reaching consequences. For the World Vision Report, I'm Dorian Jones in the village of Sinan, Turkey.
When the earthquake struck in China last month, bloggers were some of the first to get the news out. They told stories of collapsing buildings and hundreds of deaths. They used their websites to raise money and to organize volunteers. Eva Wu wrote an article about the role of China's blogs for the magazine Business Week. She told the World Vision Report's Peggy Wehmeyer that the blogs have been a real challenge to the government.
I think mostly they are questions about some of the touchy issues that state media are limited in raising those questions, are not doing enough reporting or reflecting. One would be why so many school buildings collapsed, why these constructions were so poor in quality, and were there corruption involved during the construction process?
That's pretty gutsy, isn't it, for a Chinese blogger to take on the government?
Well, yeah, I would say a lot of bloggers were raising the questions, and some of them, when we say bloggers, some are anonymous. So not everyone are blogging under their real name, and some blog posts were actually, after a while, got deleted, and some bloggers would post them on their own blog. So you can't really tell who
who wrote them.
So would it be difficult for the government to censor these kinds of blogs? Or, I mean, how did the government respond to criticism from bloggers?
Well, I think the government has been responding to those criticism. Earlier, before China received the foreign aid, that was bloggers who first raised the question why China don't receive the foreign aid earlier. And I think part of the reason, these were some of the people blogging about it, saying that the government actually listened to bloggers.
So did the government actually welcome the information from the bloggers and consider it collaborative?
Well, I think, yeah, to a large extent, yes. But also, it was because it happened so fast, and I'm not sure the government figured out how to deal with them.
How important were the bloggers to getting the information out to the people?
I think through this earthquake, people come to realize that how important actually blogging is. There was one commentary on one blog post. He or she said after May 12th, people in China will put more value on individuals' right to be informed. And a lot of them are through blogosphere, internet.
I'm wondering if this open conversation that bloggers have provided, which includes challenging the government, I'm wondering if it's opened a kind of floodgate where citizens now feel empowered to have these kinds of conversations and question the government in ways they haven't been able to before.
Definitely, definitely. Through all these blogs, there's so many more bold questions being raised that were once unthinkable.
Eva Wu, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Peggy.
Eva Wu is a journalist based in New York. She was talking with the World Vision Report's Peggy Wehmeyer. And still on the subject of blogging, but we're going back now to Kenya and to the Masai Mara Game Reserve. Earlier, Richard Locke told us how the drop in tourist dollars after last year's ethnic violence has left the game park in the red. But one park ranger has come up with an innovative way to make up for that shortfall. Richard Locke tells us the story in this reporter's notebook.
Joseph Kimojino sits at his laptop, dressed in a camouflage jacket and green beret. It's a painful experience watching him enter the latest entry to his blog with the punch of a single finger. Kimojino is a ranger with the Mara Conservancy. His official title is warden in charge of anti-animal harassment. He tells me that means it's his job to prevent tourists throwing stones at lions to make them move, or stopping photographers from luring cheetahs in closer with food. But when you visit the Masai Mara now, it's painfully obvious that Western safari-goers are giving the park a wide berth. So far this year, there have been virtually no tourists for Kimojino to monitor, and since January, the Mara Conservancy has faced a monthly shortfall of $50,000. So Kimojino has a new day job, writing a blog called Mara Triangle to draw attention to the crisis in the Masai Mara and to raise cash. The Conservancy has just barely managed to pay the rangers their salaries, but it's had to cut back its anti-poaching patrols because it can't afford the fuel. And it's suspended a cattle compensation program that pays local Maasai for livestock lost to lions and leopards. Kimojino's typing is a slow process, but I remind myself that he's a park ranger, not a speed typing secretary, and until a few months ago was computer illiterate. He had a Yahoo account, but no idea how to access it. He shifts his stare from the keyboard to take me through his latest posting.
The posting itself is about an incident that took place in the park, and some poachers sneaked into the park during the night and managed to kill the seven Thompson gazelles before they were arrested. Six of them were arrested. There were so many. And they were using dogs and torches to kill these animals.
Kimojino is now hooked on blogging. He writes about the wildlife in the Mara. For example, the fatal poisoning of two lions a few weeks ago. And it seems his audience is addicted to his blog. He regularly receives 500 hits a day from readers all over the world, especially the United States and Europe. 500 hits a day, that's incredible. I write my own blog, and I'm green with envy. What's more, his readers are donating considerable sums of money.
We managed to raise $47,000. The money that paid the salaries, almost 50% of the money came from the blog, which is very incredible.
In fact, the money Kimojino's raising is keeping the Mara Conservancy operational. It costs $1,000 just to finance a ranger for 2 months.
And now, luckily, we have 15 rangers sponsored. So the blog itself is doing something very great.
So it's thanks to your blog that the Conservancy has been able to continue with anti-poaching patrols, I ask Kimojino. He nods bashfully. He agrees that it's the response from strangers that drives him on. It's clear to me he feels he owes it to his donors to show them where their money's going.
I feel motivated and I feel like going on. I will not stop. Most important is that we are telling them now that their money they've given us is really working.
The Maasai Mara cannot afford for him to stop either. A couple of weeks ago, armed raiders from Tanzania shot a ranger twice in the leg as they stole cattle owned by local Maasai. He's had to be airlifted to a hospital. So now the Mara Conservancy faces a bill of more than $10,000. So I let Kimojino return to his one finger typing.
Richard Locke is the World Vision Report's Africa correspondent. He's based in Nairobi. To see Joseph Kimojino's blog, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also download a podcast there and take us with you wherever you go. Our team includes Chris Baldiger, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Sue Shepherd, and I'm Beverly Abel. In this week for Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.